My name is Glenn Gersmell. The topic of the session tonight is the peace movement, new possibilities, and I will be doing several things that I want to mention at the outset. One is I'll be locating the peace movement within a larger context of liberation, where I think it belongs. In fact, I think that's an exciting development of the peace movement. I will be partly reporting, as well as I have been able to determine and as well as I can present in brief period, I'll be reporting on what I see as the present state of where we're at, and I'll do a brief history, and what we face in terms of the peace movement. And secondly, projecting what I feel to be some of the key strengths of the peace movement and where some of the hope lies and where some of the potential in terms of new direction lies. Obviously, in 55 minutes, I'm not going to answer all of the questions that we raised earlier, but I do hope to cover as much of it as I can. As a starting point, I thought I would take that famous philosopher and theologian, Pogo. In one of his cartoon strips, Pogo announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, we are surrounded by insurmountable opportunities." And I think that's really a pretty good way of putting what we face in the whole issue of the peace movement. The opportunities that we face are often so looming and so challenging that they take on that aura of the insurmountable difficulties that Pogo was, I think, bouncing off of. I chose not to go back to Aristophanes and the other ancients on the history, but rather to start in the post-war period. And I've listed some of the key events along the top period, everything from Berlin and Korea, the first Vietnam War, the Guatemala invasion, Suez Crisis, U-2 and Sputnik, Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis up through Vietnam, several Arab-Israeli wars, Cambodian Laos invasion, the Chile coup, and then up into Iran, Beirut, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Grenada, Falklands, and some of the recent incidents. There are many more. There's one of the books that is listed in the guide has an entire page of about 50 or 60 conflicts that have occurred since the Second World War, of which these are only a few of the highlights, but not, by no means all of the larger ones even. The presidencies listed there just to remind us and sort of give us a sense of where we've come from. The bomb, 1945, the United States, 49, the Soviet Union, 52, Britain, 60, France, 64, China, 74, India, and it's almost certainly in the possession of or within a few months of development by at least a couple other countries. Some of the key treaties in that period: limited test ban, the hotline, outer space, non-proliferation, seabed, SALT 1 and ABM, SALT 2. I think it's real important to be, when we think about what are the possibilities and directions and strengths of the peace movement, to just remind ourselves of some of the movements that came before and that have built the organizational structure and the consciousness that lies behind much of what we see in the current peace movement, going way back to the Ban the Bomb movement, 40 or 50 solitary figures standing in the snow with placards in front of the White House. The McCarthy period, of course, during that time, the rise of the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam protests, the feminist movement, in some ways the strongest of all of them in terms of continuity into the present. And then in the 70s, the consumer, environmental, anti-nuclear power movements, in some cases in this last one, some very large demonstrations. And then into the 70s, the nuclear freeze, anti-intervention, anti-apartheid movements that we see occurring now. And then finally, I found it really fascinating to go back and look at when the various organizations were established. One of the various guides, this one, the Peace Catalog, lists about 1,000 peace groups of the at least 5,000 groups that exist in the country. Of the ones that had dates, I would say at least 3 out of 4 were in the 1980s. But it is interesting that some of them go way back. Fellowship of Reconciliation, 1914. Women's International League, 1915. American Friends Service Committee, 1917. Somewhere in the 1930s, the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, Mennonite Peace Committee, another one of the early ones, Federation of American Scientists, many of whom worked on the bomb or were knowledgeable about it enough to understand what was going on, SANE, one of the early of the umbrella or major groups, Women's Strike for Peace, Council for a Livable World. We were talking about this before the session, kind of an interesting one of the earliest really powerful groups and choosing a very legitimized arena, the legislative and electoral context to work in. Vietnam Veterans, naturally enough, Union of Concerned Scientists and NARMIC, two of the really strong think tanks, so to speak, that came out of the Vietnam period. Sojourners, the Catholic Group Network, Greenpeace fits in there. One of the largest of the coalition groups, Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy in 76. And then this the beginning of the rash of groups, and I picked out just a few. Physicians for Social Responsibility, Educators for Social Responsibility in 80 and 81, others in 81, Parents and Teachers for Social Responsibility, InterHelp, the various lawyers' committees, and so forth. I think what I mainly would like to leave this board with in terms of what we'll be talking about is, first of all, the sense of the continuity and the tradition that has just zoomed up in terms of involvement in the current peace movement, but has had rise and fall. And it's something that if you're not prepared for, you end up with what many of us felt in the early 70s, this horrible sense of the falling apart of the movement, as it was called then. And I think there's real hope that won't happen in the same way. I think there's a maturity that we have to build on now and some strengths that can prevent that. But there is inevitably a rise and fall, at the very least in the media's interest in anything. As a friend of mine who does a lot of media work in terms of trying to get media coverage on social change efforts puts it, the media has an attention span of 2 minutes on any subject. And secondly, in terms of where we want to go from here, the sense that there hasn't really been much of a period of peace, you know, at least since the Second World War, and one can count several hundred more major conflicts since our own Civil War, so that I think it's appropriate not to somehow fall into the idea that the inevitable losses and conflicts represent a failure, but rather that we're in a context where there's a waging of a struggle for peace, and to have a realistic expectation on that basis. What I hope to cover, this being having been the background, are first of all a brief summary of my sense of where our strength lies, in particular some of the things that have occurred in the last half of a decade or so. One particular issue or aspect of that strength are connections that are being made between the peace movement and local manifestations of war making, international manifestations, connection with domestic, economic, and social justice issues. Thirdly, or fourthly rather, the connection between peace and militarism, I guess more accurately, and racism, sexism, classism, ageism, and other oppressions. And fifthly, the connection between peacemaking and our personal and spiritual life. And if we have a little time at the end, I would very much like to get practical, and I've chosen for that title Joe Hill's, I think it is, famous line, "Don't mourn, organize." Okay. New strengths, to start with. I guess the most obvious or a logical place to start is in organizations. I mentioned earlier there's been a tremendous upsurge of organizations, and I periodically will hear among groups that I work with the cry, oh, it's terrible, there's so many organizations, if we could only get them all together into one, we'd be so much more effective. And there's certainly some truth to that, and we've made some progress on that level, as we'll see in a minute, but I think there's a tremendous strength in the diversity and in the grassroots quality of the peace movement. A second feature of that organizational strength is that there are many organizations that previously had not taken stands or weren't defined as groups associated with the struggle for peace that have in fact made peace a major part of their program. I think of groups like the Sierra Club or Greenpeace, Common Cause. Nobody would have thought that one of the big consumer groups of the 70s would become a genuine leader. For example, it was one of the most powerful groups in the Stop MX coalition both the last two times around. Quite a number of senior citizen groups have moved in that direction. The feminist movement, this is just one of a dozen big anthologies that I've seen of really interesting writings coming out of the feminist movement. Everything that I'll show you is either in the library or in the bookstore. This one is in the bookstore, Feminism and Nonviolence. So existing groups, otherwise not as defined as peace groups, have joined the fray. And finally, new groups. The statistic that I mentioned of the vast number of groups whose founding dates are in the 80s. A particularly exciting feature of the resurgence or plethora of groups is the number of constituencies that have groups that relate to their particular professional or other association. I have in the resource guide that I'm constructing, I've got as complete a list as I could come up with the last time it was typed. And there are scientists, architects, artists, businessmen, two groups there, children's groups, communicators, educators, scientists, high-tech professionals, lawyers, media workers, musicians, atomic veterans, again, lawyers, nurses, parents, performing artists, physicians, psychologists, psychotherapists, social workers, student teachers, united campuses, etc. Gives a sense, I think, of one of the strengths of the peace movement to see that spectrum. And then there's at least a dozen since I put this together. Athletes, for one. I think there's a way that we learn best from people we know and trust, people who speak our language. If there's one thing that I feel like I've learned from 15 or 20 years of this kind of activity, virtually full time the whole time, it's that handing out leaflets or putting things on the tube by themselves are pretty pointless. Social change or changing of consciousness occurs largely through person-to-person contact. I'll come back to that a little later. Another feature of the constituency groups is, of course, the number of religious organizations that have developed, mostly outside of the mainstream churches, although there are social justice offices in quite a number of the denominations. But I think of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which serves as an umbrella for peace fellowships affiliated with faiths such as Baptist Brethren, Buddhist, Catholic, Church of God, Disciples, Episcopal, Humanist, Jewish, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Reformed, Unitarian, Universalist, United Church of Christ, and United Methodist Church. And again, there's been one or two more since this was typed up. I think that's a real strength. Equally important, I think we've seen some real evidence of increased sophistication, and nowhere was that more evident than in the Stop MX coalition that developed last fall and then again this year. Washington Post even remarked that it was one of the most ably directed campaigns they'd seen on the legislative front, and we all know the power that lobbies have had on our congressional process in the past. One of the features has been the development of a computer network that links the members of a number of the largest of the peace groups, including the Freeze. Let's see, who are some of the others? I think the Coalition is involved in that. I can't remember the groups offhand. SANE is involved in it. So that action alerts can be sent out to the membership of quite a number of groups, the active people, to put pressure where pressure is needed. And the kind of most effective pressure is, as we all know, that middle fifth of members of Congress who are neither clearly opposed nor clearly for a given measure, but are the swing voters that really often decide, you know, where something goes. And of course, it's that swing group that was lobbied heavily by the administration with both personal appeals and personal deals. And, you know, it's, Reagan is no different than any other politician in using carrots and sticks to attempt to bring about a consensus around something, a position that he wants. So those are just a couple, I think, examples. I think there's also a considerable sophistication in resources that we now have available. And I would, if there's one thing that I'd hope people leave with, it's a commitment to expand the resource that you personally connect with in terms of information. It's clear that the daily newspaper and Time magazine are not adequate to keeping us informed about what's happening. And we had a show of hands earlier of people that are members of some of the major national peace groups. But if you haven't already sort of identified groups like the Center for Defense Information, which is headed by a couple retired admirals and admirals from the Navy, colonels from the Marines, and so forth, and is staffed by some really, really expert people in the area of defense policy, and are often quoted in the media. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, which is just an incredibly helpful group in distilling information from scores of reports and other sources and presenting them in ways that are really useful and helpful. There are others that I could mention, the Arms Control Association, Coalition for New Foreign and Military Policy, its bulletin close-up is really helpful. These are listed in the booklet, so I won't go further into that. And finally, tactics and strategies, I think, present a new level of strength. I have a few favorites which I'll share, and maybe we can pause and hear from you as well. I think the Witness for Peace idea, where people go to a place where there's a struggle and both serve as observers but also as nonviolent witnesses, in the sense of interposing ourselves, or at least presenting ourselves with the embattled party and saying, you know, we're a part of this. We share in this struggle, I think is a really important development and a really exciting strategy. Its companion program of the Emergency Response Network, where people have signed a form that says they will either participate in civil disobedience or support nonviolent actions at the drop of a hat, so that we don't have a situation like the Grenada invasion, where the first demonstrations were really days later. They just couldn't be mobilized in time, and the dust had settled by the time an effective response had happened. And that simply wasn't the case, as we saw this spring, with really very significant newsworthy actions immediately on negative votes from Congress. Maybe just open it up at this point. What are some of the tactics and strategies that you feel represent new possibilities or new strengths within the peace movement?
Can you rephrase your question?
What are some of the tactics and strategies that you've seen in the last couple of years or months that you feel represent a source of strength and hope that we're effectively using the time? You know, there are less and more effective ways of doing anything.
Well, about like movements that try to connect internationally from just people, ordinary people like ourselves, movements between nations.
Yes.
I don't know that much of that. I don't know if you know.
How it was connections between ordinary people between different countries.
Just so there's been some of those visits between Russian and American farmers, for example, is an example of what she's seen.
We raised a question on our list up there with you, but at the time the freeze movement was very high, it was a great response of people from all over the world, all over the country, that did bring that emphasis on the governor.
Up in the front row?
Just what you had brought up before, the fact that I think it's both a strength and a still area of great need growth is the fact that there are coalitions happening, that the coalitions on Central America and on the various countries are now working with the fellow peace fellowships, or with those groups, and they are sharing their, I think maybe the biggest thing, they're sharing their newsletters and that sort of, their communications.
Okay.
It has a long ways to go, but yeah.
Communications links and coalitions. Coalition for New Foreign Military Policy, I think, has over 50 really major national groups that are members, and countless other people that have subscribed individually. And its companion group, which hits perhaps a more mainstream or middle of the road audience, Campaign Against Nuclear War.
Another example is the Sojourners pulling together Peace Pentecost. That seems to be spreading to a lot of cities. And then the Peace Week that follows Peace Pentecost.
Okay. How many of you have seen the ribbon around the Pentagon? In your own local areas, where people, literally thousands of people around the country, have each made a square with an artistic design on cloth. And they're going to attach them all together and make a circle all the way around the Pentagon, representing that individual and very unique, individualistic people, artistic, in very different ways, are all saying, we want peace. It's now long enough to stretch at least 7 times around the Pentagon, and will be longer by the time it gets there, I think. I believe that's part of the Hiroshima Nagasaki Week, which you ought to mark on your calendars, August 6th to 9th. There'll be activities all over the country, and it'll be a great time to write a letter to your local newspaper and make some connections about, we talk about no first use, about the first use of the atomic weapons. 40 years ago, it's a kind of a round number anniversary that we tend to take more note of. And there'll be lots of things in the media in terms of television specials and so forth, and a chance, I think, to really look at one of the windows that, for many people, is very powerful and very moving and potentially overwhelming if there isn't someone around to help them interpret and help support them in looking at something that's very, very disturbing. There are lots of other things, from simulation games and street theater to peace camps, nuclear-free zones. There are a lot of different tactics that we're seeing being used now, and I think there's a real encouragement to think fresh and to think new in terms of ways of sharing with our community. The more one-to-one, the better, I think, is the rule. It's a long-term struggle. We don't just need a signature, so it's, you can just drag someone over and sort of against their will say, listen, you really ought to sign this petition, and then they leave, not changed at all. I think that kind of strategy is just short-term, a short-term good and a long-term failure. I think there's a real encouragement to think fresh about ways to go beyond those kinds of tactics. And one of them, I think the most important and the most hopeful, and important enough that I'd like to focus on it for 5 or 10 minutes, are connections that are being made. I think back, for example, to the environmental movement. There were I was working with a Native group at the time, and there were people that were interested in the bottle bill, and that was it. And but even on very narrowly focused issues, invariably what happened, someone would work on an issue like that for a while, and before long, the connections between perhaps that their interest was cleaning up litter or offering, you know, the nickel or penny or whatever it is for the return of a returnable to the children of the community, or perhaps the interest was limited resources and that it costs so much more money to make a new can and to wash an old bottle, etc. Whatever a person started with, invariably it connected with broader issues, even international issues, peace issues. And those connections are important to keep in mind in relating individually with people in our communities, because in fact the issues are connected, that solving issue A doesn't completely occur until issue B is also addressed. Lots of people have made the point, both philosophers and activists, that no one is free until we are all free. We can't have freedom in the North if there's still slavery in the South. We are not free in the United States as long as someone is under pass laws and the separation into isolated areas and the breakup of the family in South Africa. I think some of the most interesting connections are occurring on the local level. We're seeing lots and lots of groups take the initiative and identify local arms manufacturers or military bases or other evidences of militarism, and using those to share with their friends and neighbors information about what it means. I think when I was in Minneapolis in the late 60s, for example, I taught it in the Lutheran High School there. There was a group called the Honeywell Project, and as many as 1,000 people would be protesting out in front. And some of the issues were they were making these bombs, that small bomblets that were dropped over Vietnam in the millions, that after a certain distance from the aircraft, it would break open and scatter the small bomblets all over. And each one would explode with anti-personnel weapons, mainly. And at one point, they were testing these on rabbits in the Honeywell plant, which didn't really, you know, wasn't really greeted with a great deal of enthusiasm by some people in the community. It was a way that brought home, you know, even if it's rabbits here, it helped them connect with human beings there. And not only that, it was right during that period where the United States government researchers at Honeywell discovered that if they used plastic bomblets as the tiny little pellets rather than the metal ones, they couldn't be picked up on the X-rays that were used by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese, thus creating greater casualties and more difficult to treat wounds. And of course, being a relatively indiscriminate weapon, many, many of those were in fact children, women, non-combatants, that it was clear that they were not a part of the struggle. I mentioned that as one. Maybe again we can just see, are there people who come from communities where there are such projects related to local weapons manufacturing facilities or bases or other entities? What exists in your local area? Yeah.
Well, in the Seattle area, when the used atomic bombs are coming up on the train, they're planning a barricade of that train.
Okay. The white train that comes from Texas, that carries bombs to quite a number of parts of the country. Others? Yeah?
In Washington, D.C., just the daily protests in front of South African embassy.
Mm-hmm. Protests at embassies against South Africa. Policies, both ours and theirs. Others?
Protest of the Trident submarine, have you?
Washington and on the East Coast as well. Trident? It's got to be shyness. If you don't know, there are several resources, again, listed in the different guides. The group that I mentioned before has a hotline where they'll tell you what is there, and for a few dollars we'll Xerox a list of all the contractors that are operating in your community and send it to you. NARMIC, the AFSC-affiliated group. I'm doing really bad with names, but I'll try it. National Association on Research of the Military Industrial Complex, something like that, has produced maps, a half a dozen of them, on different aspects of the war machine, as it were, including a map that lists all of the MX contractors all over the country, another that lists bases, another sites where nuclear weapons are stored, and so forth. I think it can be a really useful way to reach some people who simply don't want to or are not in a position to, when we meet them on the bus, think about global kinds of terms, the thousands of warheads and the new developments in technology. I mean, it's many people don't relate on that level, or it's not a very meaningful relationship. But to say, in Rocky Flats, a few miles north of here, is where they assemble the triggers that blow up nuclear bombs. Our community people work in a plant that makes these that if they were ever used, would be the end of it all, in all likelihood. Oftentimes people can visualize the place you're talking about. They've driven past it and perhaps didn't know what was there. Okay, international connections we're probably most connected with, both in terms of Europe, which we'll be discussing tomorrow at 4, and I won't say more about here. The Pacific, Australia, New Zealand positions on allowing nuclear weapon ships in their areas. Several European countries are either not going to be or are considering not allowing cruise missiles in Pershing to be placed on their soil.